Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good evening, everybody. Okay, so last week we started to study the Saccheka Sutta. This is Sutta number 35 in the Majjhima Nikaya. Okay, I'll just do a brief review. The sutta centers around a polemicist or a sophist named Saccheka, who was a very skilled debater. He was reputed to be very intelligent, very gifted, and according to the commentary, he would study all of the different philosophical systems, and he travels around through this part of northern India, finding any philosopher and challenging him to a debate and then defeating him in debate. And so this made him very proud, even boastful, so that he could say that I see no ascetic or Brahmin, even one claiming to be fully enlightened, who would not shake, shiver, and tremble and sweat under the armpits if he were to engage in a debate with me. Okay, so he moves about debating with the different ascetics. Then one day when he's staying in near the city of Vaisali, he sees a disciple of the Buddha named the Venerable Asaji. And then he approaches this Venerable Asaji and he asks him what the Buddha teaches. And then Venerable Asaji explains that the Buddha teaches that the five aggregates are impermanent, and again that the five aggregates are non-self. Okay, so when Saccheka hears this, for some reason it makes him upset. He says, what I hear from you, it's very disagreeable, and I'm going to meet this Venerable Gotama, and I'm going to that's the Buddha, and I'm going to have a discussion with him, and maybe I can detach him from that evil view. Okay, so Saccheka goes to the townspeople who are called Lichavis, and he tells them, come along, come along. I'm going to meet the ascetic Gotama, the Buddha, and engage him in a debate. And I'm going to bang him around and knock him around, drag him around, and just reduce him to shreds. Okay, so everybody goes along to the monastery where the Buddha is staying. And then Saccheka, after some opening polite talk, he asked the Buddha whether he truly teaches the same thing that Venerable Asaji had told him, that all of the five aggregates are impermanent, that all of the five aggregates are non-self. Then the Buddha confirms, yes, indeed, this is what I teach my disciples. That's the way I present my instruction to my disciples. Okay, now Saccheka wants to refute the Buddha's assertion, and he does so by using a simile. He presents the simile here. I'm on page 324, paragraph 10 at the bottom. He uses a simile that just as when all seeds and plants grow, they grow based upon the earth, supported by the earth, and just as whatever deeds are done, whatever activities take place by people, All of these are done based upon the earth, supported by the earth. Okay, so in the same way, he says, a person has material form as self, and based upon material form, he does good and bad deeds. He produces merit or demerit. Again, the person has feeling as his self. He has perception as his self. He has the mental formations as self. He has consciousness as self. And based upon consciousness, he does good and bad deeds. He produces merit or demerit. Okay, I'll put on the blackboard the illustration. Okay, so according to Satchika, this is his thesis, that just as the earth is the support or basis for all of the plant life that grows and for all human activities, so analogously, in the case of a human being who does good or bad deeds, all of these deeds, good and bad deeds, are based upon the five aggregates taken as self. In other words, as according to Satchika, a self is needed as the basis for all deeds of merit or demerit. Okay, Satchika doesn't state his own position explicitly, but in paragraph 11, the Buddha draws out the implication of what he's saying. The Buddha asks them, are you asserting that material form is self, feeling is self, perception is myself, the formations are myself, consciousness is myself? In other words, the Buddha is making his underlying position explicit by making him admit openly that he's taking the five aggregates to be his self. Okay, so Satchika admits this. He says, material form is myself, feeling is myself, perception is myself, the mental formations are myself, consciousness is myself. And then he turns... He turns to the crowd that's watching and he says, I'm not the only one who says this, but this great multitude also says this. But the Buddha knows that that's not the right way to conduct an argument. So the Buddha says, leave aside the opinion of this great multitude. Just state your own position. Don't try to get to win the argument by a majority vote. Okay, so Satchika confirms that he takes the five aggregates to be self, to be his self. Okay, now the Buddha is going to undercut his argument by using a counterexample. So he says, I'm going to ask you a question, and you answer as you see fit. Okay, what do you think? Suppose there's a king, one of the most powerful kings, like King Pasenadi of Kosala, King Ajatasattu of Magadha. Don't these kings exercise power in their own realm so that they can execute anyone that they want to execute, fine anyone that they want to fine, or banish anyone that they want to banish? To us, this might be a rather frightful conception of government, where the person in authority, the king, can do whatever he wants in his land, but that's the way kingship was exercised in the time of the Buddha. Okay, so Satchika admits this, that the king can do everything that he wants, anything he wants in his land. Okay, so now the Buddha, paragraph 13, the Buddha draws out the point of his analogy. When you say thus, material form is myself, do you exercise any such power over that material form so that you can say, let my form be thus, let my form not be thus? Okay, and when the Buddha poses this question, then Satchika understands, remember, he's very intelligent, so he understands the point, at once he understands the point that the Buddha is driving at, and he just remains silent. The reason he remains silent, because he knows that once he admits that this is the case, that he's lost the argument. Okay, I'm still reviewing what we did last week. When Satchika is silent, the Buddha tells him, this isn't the time to be silent. The Buddha asks him the question a second time, and a second time Satchika is silent. Okay, then the Buddha says, this isn't the time to be silent. If anyone is asked a reasonable question up to a third time by the Buddha and he doesn't answer, his head splits into seven pieces right on the spot. Okay, this is not because the Buddha is going to punish the person, but this is the kind of spiritual power of the Buddha, that if one is engaging in a debate with him and the Buddha asks a question three times, one has to give the answer. Okay, and just when the Buddha says this, then this spirit holding a thunderbolt appears in the air just above the head of Satchika. Sort of giving him a little prompt that you'd better answer, otherwise your head is going to split into seven pieces. Okay, so then when Satchika sees this, then he's terrified, and then he turns to the Buddha and he says, ask me what you want, I'm ready to answer. Okay, so then the Buddha poses the question a third time. When you say material form is myself, do you exercise any such power over that material form so that you can say, let my form be thus, let my form not be thus? And Satchika says, no, Master Gotama. Okay, I think this is where I stopped last time. Okay, and just to bring out again the implications of this, though I dealt with it last time, I'll go over this again. What is inherent in the idea of a self, according to the Indian way of thinking, the conception of a self as it was entertained in India during this period, is that the idea of self is intimately connected with the idea of mastery. So if anything is identified as a self, that means that one has to exercise mastery over that which is oneself. And so if anything is really mine, I should be able to control it in a way so that it perfectly conforms to my desires, to my wishes. In regard to the body or material form, if the body were truly mine, truly myself, or something that belongs to myself, then I would just have to wish that this body would be always free from illness and discomfort. And just by that wish, by that act of will, the body would be free from illness and discomfort. If I want the body to be free from change or impermanence, free from old age, then I don't have to dye my hair or put on skin cream. But just by that determination, the body would not show any signs of aging. No wrinkling of the skin, no graying of the hair, no breaking of the teeth. And if I want the body to live forever, again, I just have the wish, let me not die, and I never die. Okay, so if something is truly mine, then I am the master of it. If something is truly myself, then whatever I want it to be, it will be. Okay, so Satchika must have been aware of these implications. So when the Buddha asked him whether he has any power over his body, just the way a king has power over his subjects, Satchika is forced to admit that this is not the case. Okay, so now the Buddha is calling this to his attention. Paragraph 16. He says, pay attention, Agivesana. Pay attention how you reply. What you said after does not agree with what you said before, and what you said before does not agree with what you said afterwards. Okay, again, now the Buddha is going to apply this argument, continue with the same argument. When you say that feeling is myself, do you exercise any power over your feeling so that you could say, let my feeling be thus, let my feeling not be thus? Again, Satchika has to admit, no, Master Gotama. Okay, if feeling were truly myself, then I would be able just to make a decision. Let me always experience pleasant feeling. Let me never experience painful feeling. Let me always experience extremely blissful, happy feelings, not even just inferior pleasant feelings. So I just have to make that decision, and as soon as I make the decision, the results follow. Okay, but this is not the case because our feelings are not dependent on our will. Even though I want to feel pleasant and happy all the time, but contrary to my will, I feel painful. I experience painful feelings. Okay, so next, the Buddha takes sanya, or perception. He says, what do you think, Agivesana? When you say that perception is myself, do you exercise any power over that perception so that you can say, let my perception be thus, let my perception not be thus? And again, Satchika has to admit, no, this is not the case. Okay, if perception were myself, then I would be able just to make a determination, let me perceive only things that are pleasant and enjoyable, things that are beautiful. Let me never perceive anything that's disturbing, troublesome, annoying, irritating, disagreeable. And as soon as I make up my that decision, as soon as I direct my mind in that way, my perceptions would immediately follow. But in reality, we're often forced to see things that we don't want to see, hear things that we don't want to hear, smell, taste, touch, feel things with the body that we don't want to feel. And so our perceptions are not dependent on our will, but they have a way of their own. Okay, next we come to the fourth aggregate. These are the volitions or the mental formations. Okay, so the Buddha asks him, when you say that the mental formations are myself, do you exercise any power over those mental formations so that you can say, let my mental formations be thus, let my mental formations not be thus? Okay, this particular aggregate is especially important because what is meant by the mental formations? What is the most important aspect of the mental formations? Yeah, it's intention, will, volition. And so our volition seems to be that which controls every aspect of our life. And we have a certain limited control over our volitions. For example, if I decide I want to raise my hand, I can raise my hand. So my action follows from my volition. If I want to get up, stand up, then I just make an intention. I have the intention to get up, and I can get up. Okay, but the control that I have over my intentions, over my volitions, first, the control that my volitions have over my experience is very limited. If I decide, okay, I don't want to be here, I want to go to California, I can just make up my mind, make the decision, I'm going to be in California now. And then immediately, I'm in California. I don't have complete mastery over over my position, so that just through the will I can move about any place. If I want to go to California, I have to create the conditions for that. I have to go to an airline agency, have to book a ticket, have to go through to the airport, have to get on a plane, have to travel by a plane. So it's a rather complicated process. And maybe some conditions will come up which will prevent me from traveling to California. Maybe I want to travel on a particular day, I call, and all of the planes are booked on that day, can't travel that day. Okay, so the power that my volition has over different aspects of my life, that is limited. And also the control that I have over my own volitions, that is also limited. Sometimes I want to do what is good, but mischief-making volitions come up, and I do things that are harmful and even self-destructive. I want to think certain good thoughts, noble thoughts, and then my mind has a mind of its own, and it thinks thoughts which are harmful or unwholesome. Again, self-destructive. According to Buddhism, we can gain mastery over our minds, but this is a gradual process. And even though we can get mastery over the mind in the sense that we can control our thoughts, control our intentions, but we can't get this perfect mastery so that just by deciding, let my intentions be like this, may they not be like this, they immediately follow our decision. Rather, we have to cultivate, practice this gradual process to gain mastery over our intentions. Okay, so this is the fourth aggregate. The fifth aggregate is the aggregate of consciousness, vijnana, This is what we are aware of through eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. Okay, so if consciousness were myself, then I would have to be able to exercise the power over consciousness so that I could say, let my consciousness be thus, and it will be thus. Let my consciousness not be thus, and it will not be thus. Okay, so here I want to be aware, again, only of beautiful things, lofty things, and just by deciding, if consciousness were myself, it should immediately follow my decision, my wish. If I want to go into the first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana, immediately the mind should be able to go into those states. If I want to go into the formless jhanas, again, just by wishing, I can go into those states. Of course, it's possible to develop the mind, to develop consciousness, so that one can enter into these higher states. But if consciousness were actually ourself, it wouldn't be necessary to go through this gradual process. The consciousness would immediately develop in any direction we want it to develop. We would be able to bring our consciousness into any state we want the consciousness to dwell in. Okay, so the general principle here is that if the five aggregates were really myself, really mine, things that really belong to me, then I should be able to control them perfectly so that they follow my will, follow my decree. But what the Buddha teaches again and again is that the five aggregates are not subject to our control. They're not subject to the decree of our will. But the five aggregates depend on conditions, and they exist through the support of their conditions. And so to change them, one has to change the conditions on which they depend. Okay, so Satchika has been, because he's very intelligent, very insightful, so he understands the point that the Buddha is driving at. And so when the Buddha asks these questions, each time he answers, no, that this is not the case. Okay, now paragraph 20, the Buddha is going to bring out his point even more explicitly. He says, what do you think, Agivesana? Agivesana is probably the family name of Satchika. Is material form permanent or impermanent? Okay, and so Satchika admits material form is impermanent. Okay, here the Buddha is going to be developing an argument to knock down the idea of self by showing how the idea of self is based upon two underlying premises. Two presuppositions. These two premises are permanence and being pleasurable, being a source of happiness. Okay, so the idea of self is intimately bound up with these two other ideas of permanence and being pleasurable or a source of happiness. So if I take something to be self, what I really am, my true identity, that thing has to be pleasurable. And for it to be pleasurable, it has to be permanent, everlasting, unchangeable. So now the Buddha is going to examine the five aggregates So he takes first the aggregate of material form. Is it permanent or impermanent? Satchika admits it's impermanent. Okay, then he asks the next question. Is what is impermanent bound up with suffering, or is it happiness? And then Satchika admits that it's bound up with suffering. This doesn't mean that the thing that's impermanent is always a cause of suffering or misery. But when we're holding to anything with the idea that this is permanent, this is unchanging, this will be everlasting, and then that thing changes or passes away, then it will give rise to suffering. Okay, so bodily form is impermanent. It's bound up with suffering. And so then the Buddha asks, is what is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself. Then Satchika has to admit no. And the same questionnaire is presented with feeling, perception, the mental formations, and consciousness. Are they impermanent? Are they permanent or impermanent? They're impermanent. Is what is impermanent suffering or source of happiness? What's impermanent is a source of suffering. Is what is impermanent suffering and subject to change fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself? And the answer is no. So we have here, X is the thing taken to be self, that is the five aggregates. And so when it's impermanent and suffering, even though it is taken to be self, can it legitimately be regarded as self? What do you think? Somebody is supposed to be rebellious and say yes. Okay, so when it's impermanent and suffering, then the thing which is taken to be self is actually non-self, anatta. Okay, so now paragraph 21. The Buddha here is going to be pressing Satchika even harder. He says, all along you have been adhering to what is really dukkha, what is really suffering. You've been resorting to suffering, holding to suffering. These are the five aggregates. And you've been saying or thinking, this is mine, this I am, this is myself. So these five aggregates are all along just dukkha, bound up with suffering. And yet you've been holding to these five aggregates and thinking, this is my real self. And so then the Buddha asks him, could one who's holding to these five aggregates as self ever really understand suffering and reach the complete destruction, the complete end of suffering? And then Satchika says, no, that's impossible. Then the Buddha says, in such a case, haven't you all along been adhering to suffering, resorting to suffering, holding to suffering? And isn't it just what is suffering, just dukkha, that you've been regarding, this is mine, this I am, this is myself? Then Satchika has to admit, yes, that is the case. That's what I've been doing. Okay, now the Buddha I have to say, he hits down on Satchika. It's not in a very warm, cordial, amiable way. He says it's just like a man who is searching in the woods for heartwood. And he takes an axe and he sees a large plantain tree. Do you know what plantain is? It's very similar to banana. I think it's these small bananas that one finds in South Asia. A little bit sour. Okay, but the trunk of the plantain tree is just like a banana tree. So he sees the straight trunk of the plantain tree. And then he cuts it down and then starts to unroll the sheaths, searching for the heartwood. And if you've ever seen the trunk of a banana tree, you know that when you take the sheets off one after another, all you find are other sheets beneath it. You never find heartwood. And so now the Buddha says, when you are pressed, questioned, cross-questioned about your own assertion, you turn out to be just like the trunk of the plantain tree, empty, hollow, and you're mistaken. And then the Buddha now, I have to say, he slams down on Satchika by saying, he says, weren't you the one who was boasting in front of the assembly of the people of Vaisali, saying that I see nobody, not even no ascetic or Brahmin, not even one who claimed to be fully enlightened, who would not shake, shiver, and tremble and sweat under the armpits if he were to engage in a debate with me? And that even if, this is what Satchika said, even if I were to engage a block of wood in debate, that block of wood would shake, shiver, and tremble, not to speak of a human being. And now the Buddha points to Satchika and says, now there are drops of sweat on your forehead, and the sweat has soaked through your robe, and it's falling to the ground. Satchika has been really nervous, agitated, humiliated, and his sweat is falling to the ground. But then the Buddha says, but there is no sweat on my body now. And then, very unusual for the Buddha, he opens his robe and he shows his body to the assembly. Okay, and when he says this, then Satchika is sitting there. He's silent, dismayed, gloomy, glum, unable to reply. Okay, then one of the Lichavis then comes forward and compares Satchika to a crab which had come out from a pond. And the crab was moving across the land. The crab is in the pond. Then a group of boys and girls come from the village. They come to the pond and they pull the crab out from the water and put it onto the land. And then whenever the crab extends one of its legs, rather cruelly, but this is the way children play, they cut it off or they smash the leg, so that in time all of the legs of the crab are smashed and broken. And when this happens, then the poor crab cannot get back into the pond. And so this Lichavi says, all of Satchika's arguments, all his points of debate, all of his contentions, all of them have been cut off, broken, and smashed by the Buddha. And now he cannot approach the Buddha again for the purpose of debate. Okay, but Satchika tells this Lichavi, he says, you keep quiet, I'm not speaking with you, I'm discussing with the Buddha. And now he wants to ask the Buddha a question, not to debate with him, but he wants to get some idea about the Buddha's teaching. So he asks the Buddha, in what way is your disciple one who carries out your instructions, responds to your advice, and who has crossed beyond doubt, become free from perplexity, gained self-confidence, and become independent of others in your teaching? It seems to me a little bit suspicious that Satchika would ask a question exactly like this, because this is a standard doctrinal formula that one finds in many places in the Pali Suttas. It's the formula that defines, or at least one of the formulas, that defines a sotapanna, a stream enterer. So it just seems to me unlikely that Satchika would have asked the question in which he was picking up a formula that the Buddha himself uses. In any case, this is the question that has come down in the text. And so he's asking, in effect, how a disciple is one who has reached complete certainty with regard to the Buddha's teaching. Okay, then the Buddha gives the answer. He says, any kind of material form, whatever, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, a disciple of mine sees all material form as it really is with proper wisdom. This is with the correct wisdom, correct insight. He sees, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. The same with feeling, the same with perception, the same with the mental formations, the same with consciousness. All five aggregates, in all their varieties, the disciple sees these five aggregates as being not mine, not I, not myself. Then when one has seen the five aggregates in that way, then one goes beyond doubt in the Buddha's teaching, and one gains perfect self-confidence, and one becomes independent of others. This means that when the disciple sees perfectly that the five aggregates are not self, he becomes independent even of the Buddha, no longer depends on the Buddha for guidance, because now the disciple has gained the world-transcending right view. This is the right view that sees into the very essence of the Dhamma. And this world-transcending right view can never be lost. It always remains part of the spiritual equipment of the disciple. And so, through this right view, the disciple has gone beyond, first of all, by seeing the five aggregates as non-self, the disciple gives up Sakkaya Ditti, that is, the view of a self in relation to the five aggregates. And because the disciple has seen now into the essence of the Dhamma, he's gone beyond doubt, crossed over doubt, cut off the fetter of doubt. So those are the characteristics that mark the disciple as, we call such a disciple a seka, which means one in the higher training. Okay, so now the disciple who has gained this right view is independent of others, even of the Buddha. He has the view that can lead to the complete extinction of suffering, the view that can lead to perfect liberation. But still, the disciple has to practice further to develop the other factors of the path to bring them to completion in order to gain liberation. Okay, so now paragraph 25, Sacchika asks the question, in what way is a bhikkhu an arahant, that is, a liberated one, one who has destroyed the taints, the asavas, one who has lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached the goal, and destroyed the fetters of becoming, the fetters of existence, and gained, and one who has become completely liberated through final knowledge. Okay, so this question now, again, it seems to me suspicious that Sacchika would have known a distinction between a disciple in training and an arhat. In my conjecture, this particular passage was actually put in by the compilers of the canon in order to bring out the distinction between the disciple in training and the arhat. Okay, but the answer is very important. Okay, now the Buddha answers, here, any kind of material form, whatever, past, present, or future, etc., a bhikkhu, a monk, has seen all material form as it actually is with proper wisdom. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. And through not clinging, he is liberated. Then the same thing is repeated with each of the other aggregates. Feeling, perception, the mental formations, consciousness. Each one has seen, the disciple has seen it with proper wisdom. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. And through not clinging, he is liberated. So from this, we could see that what, even though the Sakya, the disciple in training, has the correct view, the right view, but he has not yet eliminated clinging. That clinging, it's very deep-rooted. And so the rest of the path that he has to cultivate is directed towards overcoming clinging, to eliminating clinging. And so what the disciple has to do is to take that right view, the right view of non-self, and repeatedly develop that view. And then he's using that right view like a knife to cut into the mind and cut away the fetters of clinging, the bonds of clinging. And as that right view is exercised over and over again, it gradually weakens the clinging until the clinging is completely eliminated. And then there comes perfect liberation, liberation through non-clinging. Okay, then the Buddha continues, paragraph 26. He says, when a monk's mind is thus liberated, he possesses three unsurpassable qualities. What are these three? Unsurpassable vision, or you say unsurpassable insight or wisdom. Unsurpassable practice. That's because he's cultivated the path to the extinction of suffering. And unsurpassable deliverance. He's completely liberated from all of the mental fetters, liberated from all of samsaric existence, from the whole round of birth and death. But the Buddha says, the Buddha continues, when a monk is thus liberated, he still honors, respects, reveres, and venerates the Tathagata, the Buddha, thus. And so this is the reason why such a liberated monk still venerates the Buddha, with the thought that the Blessed One is enlightened and he teaches the Dhamma for the sake of enlightenment. The Blessed One is tamed and he teaches the Dhamma for taming oneself. The Blessed One is at peace and he teaches the Dhamma for the sake of peace. The Blessed One has crossed over birth and death, and he teaches the Dhamma for the sake of crossing over birth and death. The Blessed One has attained Nibbana, and he teaches the Dhamma for the attainment of Nibbana. Okay, when the Buddha says this, then Sacchika feels embarrassed and apologetic, and he expresses his embarrassment in paragraph 27. He says that, I was bold and impudent in thinking I could attack the Buddha in debate. This is like attacking an elephant, like attacking a blazing fire, like attacking a poisonous snake. And so I was extremely foolish. And then Sacchika invites the Buddha, together with his company of monks, to come for the next day's meal, to receive the next day's meal from him. And then the Buddha consents in silence. Okay, when the Buddha consents, then it seems that Sacchika didn't have a house of his own, didn't have a facility of his own, but he was like a wandering debater himself, and he didn't have his own wealth, means of support. And so he had to turn to the Lichavis, his companions, and said, I've invited the Buddha and the Sangha to come for tomorrow's meal. Bring me whatever you think is suitable. Okay, and so the Lichavis, these are the householders, they prepare all of the food, and then they bring it to Sacchika. Sacchika is staying in a park. This is probably a park set aside for the wandering ascetics. So Sacchika is staying in this park. The Lichavis, the town people, they all bring their food to Sacchika. And then Sacchika invites the Buddha and the monks. They all come to the park. Then Sacchika serves the Buddha and the monks with his own hand. Okay, then paragraph 30. Sacchika, after the meal, he takes a low seat and he says to the Buddha, may the merit and the fruits of this act of giving be for the happiness of the givers. And here, apparently, he's referring to the Lichavis. But the Buddha says to him, whatever comes from giving to a recipient such as yourself, one who is not free from lust, hatred, and delusion, that merit will be for the givers, that is, for the Lichavis. And whatever merit comes from giving to a recipient such as myself, one who is free from lust, hatred, and delusion, that will be for you. In other words, the Lichavis prepared the food and they brought the food not to give to the Buddha, but to give to Sacchika. And so they get their merit is that from giving to Sacchika, who is still a deluded ordinary person. Then Sacchika takes the food and makes the offering to the Buddha. And so Sacchika gets the merit from giving to one who is free from greed, hatred, and delusion. Okay, so this is the end of the Chula Sacchika Sutta. Okay, now, if there's any questions, then please feel welcome to ask. Yes?
Could you comment on the forcefulness of the Buddha's way of driving home his point is that to counteract the pride of Sashaka, or to help him realize a further stage of enlightenment?
To realize what?
To get further along the path, because he is so deluded.
Yeah, he's very proud. So I think the Buddha has to break down his pride. It seems a bit harsh, yeah. This seems to have been the style of debating. But there are other, I have to say, there are other suttas that come in this, especially a work called the Sutta Nipata. It's in chapter 4, called the chapter on the eights, in which the Buddha speaks about how the debates take place during his time. And he says that when the different parties engage one another in debates, each one holds to his own view as being true and thinks the view of the other one is false. And so they bombard the opponent with thunderbolts of harsh criticism. They knock down the component with proud mind, with fierce mind. They knock down the component, and then they go away thinking, I have defeated the other, I am superior, he is inferior. And I don't want to criticize the Buddha, but it seems he's doing the same thing here.
Maybe in Sachaga's case, it was he needed it for his own enlightenment.
Probably so.
There's another discourse to Sachaga that comes immediately after this, number 36. And apparently number 36 came at a later time. And even at the end of number 36, Sachaga doesn't declare himself to be a disciple of the Buddha. Often we see when somebody engages the Buddha in a discussion, at the end he'll be convinced, and then he'll say that I go for refuge to the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha. Let the Blessed One accept me as a refuge. Let the Blessed One accept me as one who has gone for refuge from today until the end of my life. But Sachaga doesn't make that statement, that declaration. So it seems that despite all of the time that the Buddha invested in arguing with him, he didn't really get convinced about the Buddha's teaching. But the commentary says that even though Sachaga didn't become a disciple of the Buddha in that lifetime, but several centuries later, he was reborn in Sri Lanka, and then he became a famous monk in Sri Lanka who achieved arhatship. How the commentary knows this, I don't know. Yes, please.
Yes, the Buddha seems to be drawing a distinction between the merit that the Vichavis received, as opposed to Sachaka. And there's a distinction. He seems to be drawing a distinction between the two kinds of merits and the offering of the clue. Can you draw that out a little bit?
Oh, you want me to draw that out?
Well, you see, the merit is supposed to be dependent upon two factors. One is the subjective state of the giver, and the other is the receiver, the virtuous qualities of the receiver. Okay, so in the case of the Lichavis, let us say the sutta doesn't deal with the intention of the givers, but it's basing the distinction on the virtuous qualities of the receivers. In the case of Sachaka, he is not yet free from the defilements, from greed, hatred, and delusion. And so when the Lichavis present the food to him, they get merit, but it's not the same as the merit that will come from giving to one free from the defilements. But Sachaka takes the food and he gives it to the Buddha. So he will get the merits that come from giving to one who is free from defilements. Yeah, that is the point.
And it seemed that was Buddha drawing a distinction between he and the Buddha, saying you and I are not alike? Was he making a statement also to Satchika there?
Yeah, he's indicating that there's this difference between them. That Satchika still has greed, hatred, delusion, whereas he himself is free.
Kind of like one last parting shot.
It seems that way. Okay, Suki.
Regarding the impermanence and not self, the Buddha states the formations are impermanent, and things, the Dhamma, are not self. So one he uses formations.
Yeah. Why formations in regard to impermanence?
Right.
And dhammas or things in regard to non-self?
Right. Is there any significance or it seems to me not everything which belongs to Dhamma is not always impermanent. That kind of, something is there. Can you explain why he used two different...
Okay, this is it's an interesting distinction. And I haven't seen any explanation of that I haven't found any explanation of the reason for that distinction in the suttas themselves. Even the commentaries are not so clear about the reason. Though I've seen some commentaries say that sabbe sankhara. Sankharas are things which are created by conditions, brought about by conditions. Okay, so everything brought about by conditions is impermanent. Okay, all dhammas are not self. A dhamma means anything existing. So what is said is that dhamma has a wider range than formations. The Dhamma includes things that are brought about by conditions, and also it includes the unconditioned Nibbana. And so the explanation is given, Nibbana is not impermanent. Nibbana, you could say even Nibbana is permanent. It's unchanging, unborn, unaging, deathless. But Nibbana is not a self. Not something that one could take to be I, mine, or myself. And so Nibbana is a Dhamma which is not self. Okay, that's an explanation I've seen in later commentaries. I'm not sure that that explanation is actually based on the texts themselves. Maybe, maybe not. But I don't have a definitive explanation. Kim, you have a question.
Hi, Monty. On paragraph 25 toward the end, the Buddha said that through non-self and through not clinging, he's liberated.
Yeah.
By not clinging, is that there are different levels of clinging? Like if one can cling to material wealth, material things, or one can cling even to spiritual things, is there like a distinction?
Of course there are different types of clinging, different levels of clinging. But here it's meant the giving up of the subtlest clinging. The text sometimes distinguish four types of clinging. Clinging to sensual pleasures. Clinging to views, clinging to rites and rituals, and then clinging to a doctrine of self. Okay, and somebody who's liberated through not clinging has given up all four of these types of clinging. Or we could say, also that clinging is clinging to the five aggregates. So one who has gained the right view or proper wisdom that the five aggregates are not mine, not I, not myself. Such a person won't cling to the five aggregates with the belief that they're mine or I or myself. But they'll still cling to the five aggregates and take them to be I and mine, even though they don't formulate any belief that the aggregates are mine, I and mine. But it's just a kind of instinctive, natural, deeply ingrained clinging. But when one develops this insight to the deepest level, then one gives up this clinging to all of the five aggregates as being mine or I, not just to the belief that they're mine or I, but even the subtlest notion, the subtlest idea, these are mine, this is I, that is given up.
So would you say that that's the subtlest level, when one can abandon the self? Would that be the, of all the four? Would that be the subtlest level, when one can abandon?
That is the subtlest level, yeah. That is what's meant by becoming liberated through non-clinging. Okay, any further questions? Okay, then we will end for the night. Okay, so we will end with the sharing of the merits. Okay, so we share the merits with the devas. These are the deities that protect the Dhamma. The Buddhas, or harmful spirits, and with the whole world, with all beings in the world, asking them all to be well and happy. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.